Thank you, Shinhui, and good morning to everybody. Thanks for sticking around for this session. I really appreciate being here with my colleagues. As many of you know, I've moved to Kansas State University about 6 months ago, but in fact, the work I'm going to talk about today is from my former institution, Oklahoma State University. We will be continuing with stored product IPM research at K-State, but in a different and slightly reduced level. Well, there's been some good overviews already about what's going on with fumigants in North America. I just thought I'd give a quick overview of what we have. Methyl bromide is still a registered product. It is still being used, although it is being phased out. I say here the Clean Air Act because that is the legislation that the U.S. is using that is facilitated by the Montreal Protocol. It is still allowed, and this is internationally, for quarantine and pre-shipment purposes. In other words, commodities that have to be pest-free before they leave the country or before they come into our country. The stickler that David has referred to a lot here is this critical use exemption, which is requested every year based on, you know, I don't have anything that works or that does it as well, and blah, 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 as Paul said. So that's still every year that comes up, and the critical use exemptions are decreasing yearly. The main fumigant that we use in North America, at least in the U.S., for stored grain is phosphine gas. This will be the one for some time to come, especially the solid phosphide formulations, the aluminum phosphide, magnesium phosphide. They're very cheap, they're very easy to use and effective if you know how to use them properly. Of course, we have newer formulations that are registered and available where phosphine is in a cylinder, a tank cylinder, such as EcoFume, which is only 2% phosphine with CO2, but we have 100% phosphine that can be released with air or with CO2 in very controlled releases. Highly effective, but more expensive and more specialized. And sulfuryl fluoride, as David mentioned, has been registered over the last several years for cereal grains and then for other specialty commodities, dried fruits and nuts, more recently for structures and food processing facilities, and it's a non-ozone depleter, can be considered an alternative, not a direct substitute for methyl bromide. So that's just the overview. I guess the one I haven't mentioned here, which was recently given tolerances, is methyl iodide, but I don't have any direct information on that at this point. Maybe next year. So in my talk, I'm actually going to delve into some research data in some detail. One is on with sulfuryl fluoride as an alternative. We're going to talk about some studies we did at OSU on SF. A non-chemical method, vacuum or low pressure, to achieve a low oxygen controlled atmosphere. So controlled atmospheres is a non-chemical alternative to fumigation, very much like applying a fumigation though. And then a new, an idea of using something that's considered relatively safe, almost organic, it would be ethyl formate as an example of a natural fumigant. We did some studies there. So I'll go through a few experiments here. First, a little background on sulfuryl fluoride. It is known as Profume for the food industry, but of course it's been registered since 1961 as Vicane for wood-destroying insects, mainly and termites and wood-boring insects. When you go to the southeast, you go to Hawaii, you see a house under a brightly colored tent. This is being fumigated with Vicane. Recently registered as Profume, as we said, Diagra Sciences has the product and for various durable commodities. We've conducted studies then on what's referred to as sorption in commodities and also the treatment of high-value products to see if there's any effect. Sorption is important because when the gas goes in and is absorbed by a commodity, then there's less gas available to kill insects. So this has to go into the formula for treating the commodity. Now, the sorption studies we did initially were on three main cereal grains, wheat, corn, and rice. We used large glass jars in the laboratory. We tested three different doses, three different temperatures, did three replicates of each grain. We held them for up to 7 days and took gas samples periodically at 1, 2, 4, 8, 24, 48 hours, 5 days, and 7 days to see how the gas concentrations changed in those jars. We also had jars with no grain but filled with the same doses of gas, held at the same temperatures to see if there was change in gas in those jars over time without any grain. We did quantitative GCMS, focusing in on this ion fragment 83, which was characteristic for sulfuryl fluoride. And at the end of the 7 days, we would open the jars in the hood, flush them for 30 seconds with air, close them up, and then take gas samples at 1, 2, 4, and 24 hours to look for degassing. If gas is sorbed, it ought to be desorbed. So just quickly the results, as opposed to having numerical data. All the jars that contain grain showed substantial gas loss over the course of the experiment. And all of these could be described then by an exponential decay curve and regression analysis. Jars that had no grain at all showed virtually no grain loss. Okay, so we had nice tight gas-tight jars. The gas loss was greater when the temperatures were warm versus cool. That kind of will be expected if there's some chemistry going on. Wheat, for example, showed 50% loss over 7 days. Rough rice lost anywhere from 90 to 100% by the end of 7 days. But corn was starting to lose, in some cases, 100% at 3 days, and all of the corn samples had no detectable SF by day 7. So that's a lot of absorption. There was no SF detected coming off the jars after they had been ventilated and allowed to degas, so to speak. We found no gas coming off over 24 hours. So gas went in, gas didn't come out. This is work Charlie Coneman did, actually, and went on to look at 9 specialty commodities. And so this is a little bit more data-oriented here, but basically these are the decay curves, the regression statistics for the decay curves of 48 hours of these different commodities: soybeans, cocoa, popcorn, cowpea, polished rice, coffee, apricots, figs, etc. What you want to see is here there is a very high R-squared for some commodities and a negative slope, in other words, showing a loss of gas over the 48 hours. Soybeans in particular, but for example, in raisins, had a slope that was essentially non-existent and no R-squared and a very non-significant effect. So we have some that are highly absorptive, so to speak, losing gas over time, some that are not. So you have every commodity is just a little different. And again, here our empty jars showed no loss of gas, and there was no off-gassing after the flushing period. So what about absorption in these commodities? Well, a lack of, since there was no gas loss in our controls, meant we had nice tight jars. There was no other degradation going on in those jars. Commodities obviously had a significant effect on change in gas concentration, with the ranges being a whole lot happening in things like soybeans and not much happening in raisins, a lot happening in corn, for example. The lack of detectable gas after the treatment showed that it went in, something happened, and it didn't come out, at least not in 24 hours. It did not degas. And then what is absorption? Okay, well, really, what it is, I used to think that it's happening like a sponge, and you ought to be able to get it out. But in our example, it's basically unexplained loss of gas, probably due to a chemical reaction or chemical-physical interaction with the commodity. Okay, my chemistry, inorganic chemistry colleague says that fluoride-containing compounds are highly reactive with lots of different materials, so we're probably having breakdown product. We do know, in fact, that there are fluoride ion residues, which I'll get to next, which is in this study. We looked at the use of Profume on value-added food products. Basically, we had a company who wanted to know if they went from methyl bromide to Profume, would they experience any problems with their products or with their worker safety or their application methods. So we did a small-scale field trial in which we used 20-foot shipping containers that were sealed as fumigation chambers, and we applied Profume at a low dose, a high dose, and then we had an untreated control. So we had 3 shipping containers at OSU that we used. These represent low doses and high doses. In fact, again, CT, concentration time product, the maximum label rate is 1,500. So we're near the top, but we're not quite at the max for that. We set up experimental pallets that contained 11 different food products, all right? So it was a variety of food products, and I'll show you some examples. We also put insects in there, in other words, jars, ventilated jars of insects that contained egg, larvae, pupae, and adults of several species, so they were mixed bioassays, mixed life stages. We also had an open jar of field corn, because we knew from our absorption study that there's a lot of absorption on corn, and we included that as a positive control for our residue analysis. Now the key here is we're looking for fluoride ion residue. Now if you brushed your teeth this morning, you had a little bit of fluoride in your toothpaste probably. Fluoride is toxic to bacteria in your mouth. It's toxic in general, and it's added to water in some communities to help with tooth decay. The issue is, the potential is we're adding a little more fluoride to the food system when we fumigate with sulfuryl chloride. We took gas samples around the pallets. We also tested for the fluoride ion residues in all of our materials. And the company also went ahead and did baking tests and sensory analyses on these products to see if there were any effects. Here's the shipping container, an example of one of the three shipping containers we used. Gas sampling ports going in here. Here's Randy Beebe sealing up one of the containers. We just used very simple tape. Edmund Bonjour is here putting on a warning label that we're conducting a fumigation. Here's some of the products we received from the company, and then when we set up our experimental pallet with the 11 different commodities, we have basically a case as an example of each type of food. We had things like cake mixes, biscuit mixes, cornbread, frosting for cakes, shortening, and so forth. Here's our insect bioassays in these jars. Here's a jar of corn, I believe. Here's a temperature meter. We're also taking gas samples throughout. You can see the nice sealing job in the chambers. They're very nicely sealed. Here's a sampling syringe for taking gas samples around at the end of the fumigation, around the pallet and so forth. We take the samples, cap them immediately, and take them back to the lab. So here's at the end of the fumigation. These are 24-hour treatments. Open the door, turn on the fan, and then test the air coming out to make sure we reach the label acceptable rate of 1 ppm for re-entry of the facility. Charlie's going in there, taking a gas sample under the shrink wrap, inside the boxes, through the containers, and so forth. Then we're even taking some of the product, putting them in glass-sealed jars, taking them back to the lab and seeing if there's off-gassing. And remember, again, if gas goes in, it might come out. So we just check that over a 24-hour period. Okay, just to go right to the quick here with the results. After all the fumigations and the clearances were satisfied, there was no detectable sulfural fluoride around the pallets, underneath the shrink wrap, under the boxes, etc., either outside or inside the food cases. We had those products in the glass jars for 24 hours. We detected no off-gassing of products in those sealed jars in a one-day period. Now, we did have a case then when we went into some of the food packages. We actually poked the syringe into the inner bag of certain mixes or the foil liners of others, and out of many dozen of samples, we had three cases where we come up with some positives. Sort of interesting. One can of frosting had 26 ppm of SF inside under the foil. A box of cornbread mix also had a very low level. One can of vanilla frosting had 329 ppm. So some gas went in and stayed in. Now remember, I didn't mention this, but the intention of the fumigation in this case is to kill insects that are around the environment of these packages. The hope is that the food has no insects inside. And of course, in things like frosting and shortening, we wouldn't expect stored product insects. But some gas got in. We only allowed a day to escape, so probably over time there would be no gas. But in general, the large majority of the packages were resistant to gas penetration. What about fluoride ion, that nasty toxic element that can get in the food? Well, of all the treated foods that were tested, we got very, very low levels of ion. In other words, between 0.16 and 0.60 ppm in the treated foods, well below the 70 ppm level that the EPA requires for these sorts of foods. The corn, okay, we had field corn in an open jar as a positive control. So in the untreated controls, it contained 0.15 ppm of SF, but in our treated containers, where the jars were there, 6.21 and up to 15.36 ppm for the low and high dose, respectively. So we did absorption in materials that were absorptive, but the foods were protected and did not absorb anything. Baking and quality tests were all positive. They could find no difference between fumigated and treated products. The taste panel had no problem as well after they did multiple tests on those. The baking quality was fine. The company generally is willing, and probably by now has gone, from methyl bromide to sulfural fluoride. In the insect bioassays, all of the insects were dead. No insects survived, and we held them up to 6 weeks afterwards. That's the idea. Since we had eggs and pupae, we wanted to make sure that everything was killed. So it was an effective fumigation. A little bit of concern about some of the packages being allowing gas to get in. Okay, now to switch gears to a non-chemical method, modified or controlled atmospheres. And what we're talking about here is just changing the concentrations of atmospheric gases. One controlled atmosphere treatment would be a high carbon dioxide. And as David mentioned, this is very difficult to achieve in an unsealed structure. So you need to use special structures for high CO2. Low oxygen can be achieved by displacing the air in a room with an inert gas such as nitrogen, and you try to get down to something actually more like 2% or 1% oxygen. You can kill insects. These are controlled atmospheres. Modified atmospheres, which can occur under hermetic sealing, is where the commodity itself and some of the other organisms modify the atmosphere in there by being aerobic and creating CO2 and using up oxygen through normal respiration and then creating a killing atmosphere. These have been researched a lot in Europe, Israel, a little bit in the United States. What we looked at, though, was a controlled atmosphere with something very simple where you use vacuum to just remove the air from the system and create a low oxygen atmosphere. We were shooting for 2% or less. We know that that's lethal to insects. We did several studies over several years. We published these on the efficacy of low pressure. And we looked at differences in temperature and hold times. And like a fumigation, the effectiveness increases with higher temperatures and longer hold times. This can be applied, though, to bulk bagged and packaged commodities using a device called a cocoon, which I'm going to show you a photo of soon. But in the laboratory, we collected lots of dose mortality data on several species of stored products, insects. We mainly focused on eggs and pupae, as Paul mentioned, being the most tolerant life stages. And for example, the red flower beetle eggs, Indian meal moth eggs. And these are our vacuum chambers. They're just 1 gallon glass jars that are gas tight. They have various ports for removing air, entering compounds. But here would be the bioassays down here, little ventilated vials containing known numbers of life stages of different insects. So as I said, mortality will increase with temperature and decrease with pressure. As you have a higher pressure, you have lower mortality, you want to get a lower pressure, lower oxygen. Durable commodities can survive the treatment. Now here's some example of mortality data, okay, as a function of temperature and pressure. So what we're looking at are the values following dose response studies that are actually the lethal time to kill 99% of the eggs of two species. Now at 50 millimeters of mercury, we're at about 2% oxygen. At room temperature, it would take 58 hours to kill 99%, but at something close to human body temperature, it would take 17 hours. So just like a fumigant, it gets better with heat. But that's 2% oxygen. If we go to 4% oxygen, which is 100 millimeters of mercury, you can see the effect is not as good. Same thing with red flower beetle eggs. In other words, it takes almost 3 days to kill at room temperature, but only 11 hours to kill at a hotter temperature. But if we have a higher pressure, more oxygen, 4% oxygen, the kill is not as good. But even there, we can get a 20-hour kill at a warm temperature. So the data are available. We know what the guidelines should be for killing. This is now the commercial scale. This is the cocoon developed by, manufactured by GrainPro Inc. It is flexible PVC that goes together in two halves. And there's actually a nice little Ziploc seal around the middle there. It's good for any durable commodity that can withstand the pressures. We have a rotary vane pump that's drawing at 45 cubic feet per minute when it's full open. It's just sucking out all the air in there. We're getting down to about 2% oxygen or 25 to 50 millimeters of mercury. This is a pressure sensor right here that's hooked up to a solenoid with a feedback loop so that the pump can go on and off and hold that pressure and keep it there. What we're looking at here actually is cacao from Central America, which is rather oily, and there's some issues there with oils being trapped in the pump oil. Again, bags, bag sacks, etc. Very low cost, very safe. There's no chemical inputs. You're just taking air away, so this can be done while workers are in the same room. With George Mbata and under a methyl bromide grant, we did some more commercial size treatment, and this is using the Pitts tunnel. Okay, so that last cocoon is about five tons of product. This can hold up to 20 tons of product. This is the size of a 20-foot shipping container. We were out in California. We're going to load this thing up with beans, okay, edible beans. And in fact, They're in super totes. So these are one-ton super bags filled with beans, and basically we just demonstrated that we could, and we only filled it up halfway. So these are 10 one-ton bags. We could easily have 20 or more filling in the cracks and treat that much, and we did reach the treatment protocol. Okay, lastly, I just want to talk a little bit about an alternative chemical, one that can be considered more of a green compound, ethyl formate. Okay, it's the formic acid ester of ethanol. It, in fact, can be considered a botanical insect. It's one of the compounds you get it's a fruity ester. When you bite into an apple and you smell this fruity smell, it's in that family of compounds. We wanted to develop just a four-hour treatment at room temperature because that would match the APHIS PPQ sort of treatment like methyl bromide is done with. We did studies on Indian meal moth and lesser grain borer using eggs. And we checked ethyl formate alone, but also in combination with vacuum, and that's the key message here. We used our glass vacuum chambers again, and we allowed, so we would take down the vacuum in the combination treatment, make a vacuum, and then inject ethyl formate, which would volatilize at room temperature. Let's just look at some basic mortality data. Vacuum alone, at 4 hours, 25°C, at one of the good vacuums, we're not going to kill very many insects in the case of Indian meal moth eggs, only 10% mortality. Ethyl formate alone in 4 hours at up to 150 ppm, we can only get 88% kill. But combining ethyl formate with vacuum, you can see our control here only had 3% kill. All of these will be at 50 millimeters of mercury, so at 2 ppm of ethyl formate, we had 9%. We double that, we go to 50%. And here at this point, only 8 ppm of ethyl formate, we got 100% kill of our Indian meal moth eggs. Computed the LD99 would require 8 ppm at 4 hours at that pressure. Lesser grain borer, generally a more difficult insect to kill. Vacuum only, we only got as good as an 8.5% kill under the best vacuum conditions. With ethyl formate, we had to go up to 200 ppm to get 100% kill. But in the combination, we see again a benefit of combining these, and we can get 100% kill at only 50 ppm of ethyl formate and a combination with the vacuum. So these are just some ideas of how we can have alternatives to fumigants. The vacuum is very safe. Ethyl formate is being commercially developed in Australia, actually formulated in tanks with CO2. It does not have label status in the U.S. So, general conclusions after that whirlwind of data, just to say again, as we already know, Profume can be an alternative for methyl bromide. I mentioned alternative for phosphine because we do have some concerns with resistance to phosphine of certain insect populations, so SF provides another mode of action to go after those insects with in grain. Vacuum can deliver a low oxygen atmosphere, and it is pesticide free and would be considered organic. The cocoons and larger units can be used safely and on high-value products. And combination treatments, there's still a lot to be done with combination treatments. And in this case, vacuum and ethyl formate could provide something that would even be organically compliant with our national organic standards. Acknowledge various sources of funding, but particularly the people involved in a multiple of studies that will still have yet to be published. Involving Tom Atkinson and Joy Rogers from Dow AgriSciences, Randy Beebe, Edmund Bonjour at SPREC, Charlie Coneman there also, Raj Hulasar is now with Temp Air, George Mbata is with Georgia Southern, Fort Valley State, and Jeff Weir with Sprague Pest Control. And with that, thank you for your time.